It's Wednesday, May 14th, 2014, and you're listening to episode 339 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 46 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Chad.
My name is Pat.
And this is Chris.
Yes, it's the only podcast on the internet that sounds like granite and truth.
I don't get that.
As opposed to leather and desperation.
it's an in-joke. I'll post a link to this in the show notes, but Laura Anderson posted something on her Facebook wall. I don't know where she got it from, but that's just who I saw it from. And it was this thing about weaknesses only protagonists can have. And it seems to focus specifically on female protagonists. Mm-hmm. One of them is like, she's blushing and somebody tries to fire her because blushing is a sign of weakness. But somebody who's higher than she is like, no, blushing is a sign of she's in touch with her emotions. You're promoted. You run the company now. And it's a joke. The whole thing's intentionally a joke about poor character dialogue and things like that. It's freaking hilarious. I'm not doing it any justice. I'll just link it. Go read it yourself. I'm not doing justice.
But fair enough.
There was a phrase in there that had me really cracking up, probably because of the context of how it was used. Well, see, it's intentionally bad writing.
But purple prose.
Yeah, it's flipping hilarious.
There's a writing society that does a purple prose contest every year. They give an award to, you know, people intend, not that are in books, but that people write, here's my sentence or two sentences of purple prose, and then they judge the worst ones, and there are some doozies.
So is this stuff that's intentionally bad?
Oh, yeah, it's intentionally bad, yeah.
Because
yeah,
I know there's also people that do the awards every year for, like, the worst unintentionally bad books. And one of the funniest things they put out every year to read is the worst sex scenes from fiction that year. And typically they're not all that graphic. They're just awful. And I don't mean awful as in that's disgusting.
Terrible.
It's just so poorly written that it's like this. I don't know. This is just not something that should be written. I don't even know how to describe them. I don't have a link on that one. But if you're able to track it down.
It's like an improper use of the word moist or something.
All right, so what I want to talk about on this show, I got a question here from Nathan. I'm not going to give his last name, so I don't have permission to. Plus, on top of that, I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce it. I've got about three or four ways in mind, and one of them might be right.
Yes.
But we'll never know. He writes me as follows. Question on gaming. How would you rule a cleric without a deity? Sort of like someone believing in justice so much that they become able to channel that raw belief, yet not in a god. All right, now at first I got to thinking about this, well, because he PM'd me. There was a setting for D&D that I was messing around with some years back. And one of the things that I had in there wasn't exactly like this, but kind of goes in that direction, which is I wrote a monotheistic setting. And the idea was that each cleric within there did not follow multiple gods because there was only one god. And there was no real disagreement on that fact. So I guess when you have clerics who can, you know, raise the dead and such, you really can't have meaningful theological debates. But when they would follow this god, they would typically devote themselves to an order, think like patron saints, that focus on a particular aspect, compassion, justice, whatever. And out of that, you kind of get these clerical orders. Now, it's not quite the same as what Nathan's asking about, because there was still a deity in the chain. But really, what the person was devoted to was more of a set of ideals. So I got to thinking about that in context of this question. It's like, you know, you could take that one step further and talk about somebody who draws power from a set of ideals or maybe some kind of a really powerful passion. An example we gave in discussing this pre-show was World of Darkness. You have a hunter, or maybe in a Dresden game, similar thing. You have some kind of, you know, mage where they draw their power from a desire for revenge or a conviction that the world ought to be purged of the supernatural. And obviously, this is not going to work in a game that has absolutely no magic whatsoever. But I think within any game that does have magic, you could look at a question like this. Can you have somebody that is either following a belief system that is not specific to any supernatural power, or perhaps following a belief system, and this person may, in their heart of hearts, be an atheist.
I believe, and if Johann or John was here, they could speak to exactly which point this is, if it's 3.0 or 3.5. But I think in 3.5, they put forth that idea when they were discussing clerics that, yes, you can, of course, follow, here's your selection of deities, here's their spheres or whatever. But they also put forth that you can follow a certain cause or a set of values, which could be interpreted between the player and the game master, and then you kind of build things from there. So it's not like you are necessarily following a deity. You're following this essential set of causes,
right?
And you go forth from there. So it does exist, I guess.
Well, and he asked me how I would handle it as a game master. And I think my biggest concern is that I would want to separate it from something like, let's say, a sorcerer, from somebody who simply draws the magic from themselves. Because what sets a divine caster or a similar character type in any of these games apart from the other caster types is the fact that they don't draw their power from within. Their power is coming from an external source. And that external source gives them a set of strictures that that character did not create and only has limited room to interpret. And any deviation from those strictures is going to result in some kind of a consequence to the character. And that creates an opportunity for the game master kind of role play. You know, I suppose if you take the deity out of the picture, you still can talk about what the order requires, or even if there's no order, what the code, you know. If somebody came to me and said, look, I just want to be somebody who's really mad and I get divine magic from that, I don't know whether I'd allow it as a game master. Because you have to accept that in any of these games, there are both qualitative and quantitative game balancers. The quantitative ones, the numeric ones, are, well, you get spells, but in return you have a lower amount of hit points. These are quantitative balancers. But a lot of times there are qualitative balancers, which are, okay, even though we can't put this into math, there's something we're putting on your character that helps balance you out a little. Okay, you're an arcane caster. You have to stop and memorize your spells, which in the earlier editions of D&D, it could literally take days or even weeks to memorize your spells for a single day. And so as a game master, I would want to know that there is still some external pressure. This is not just, well, it's my code, whatever I make up as I go. You know, if you want to say, look, I'm following like the Hagakure or something like that. Okay, maybe if everyone's not familiar, that's a book that gave kind of instructions and code for how the samurai were to behave. But I still say, okay, we have a fixed set of values. There's a fixed point you have to follow. I'll let you be an atheist or whatever you want to be. But there's this immovable point that you still have to adhere to.
I guess the first question that I have, and I don't know if this is in what he PM'd you or not, is he imagining that you're playing in a game world where there's just no God, period? There are no gods at all?
Or you've chosen not to follow.
That's what I said. Or is it that there are gods and there are clerics and your player just doesn't want to be, I don't want to follow so-and-so. Because if that's the case, for me at least, it would be a more easy answer of saying, okay, gods do exist, and that's where the clerical power comes from. You're not really following one, but really you are. That's where you're drawing your power. You may not be praying to said god, but something about you has caught that god's eye, and he's allowing this for you. That's at least the way I would sort of see it. Now, if it's that there's no gods, period, in the world, it's a little bit harder, I think, to come up with. For me, I think it would be more along the lines of like the like what you were saying, Dan, like some kind of an order or more sorcery still. Because to me, it's magic is magic, be it divine or arcane. You know, in a world with no god, if magic does exist, then it's just a different sort of a flavor of it. And you can come, I think I could see coming up with some kind of a thing. But it's more world driven to me than just character driven.
Right.
Because in this world where there's no gods, you have to come up with how is there clerical type magic or, you know, the divine type magic in the first place.
You do run into, a little bit of a game balance sort of issue where if there aren't any deities, but yeah, people follow certain codes and get certain spell-like benefits for it, then suddenly the attraction of playing other classes, it kind of goes away. I mean, there might be some, you know, you could almost with that magic compensate for anything that you wouldn't get as a benefit-wise from those other classes. So I think that your initial point about making sure that that code is kind of laid out and the strictures are there so that as a game master, A, you know, you can introduce some good story elements into there, but then also to kind of monitor and make sure that, you know, the player is just not, you know, trying to game the game, basically, and just get the benefits. There has to be some sort of check to that power that's in there, otherwise it can get out of whack if the player is not, you know, really buying into what they're doing, if they're doing it for the wrong reasons, basically.
don't really think that balance is 100% necessary in games. I think people put a lot of stock in it because sort of the granddaddy of gaming is the D&D style game, the Pathfinder style game. And in those kinds of games, a lot of the focus of how the game is meant to be played, again, not how it's normally played by people, is that it is a combat-intensive game and that there are encounters and the encounters have to be balanced and your characters can die, but they get gains, and it's much more gamey than it is story. Again, not to say there isn't a story, but again, we're talking about how it's intention. You're going through dungeons, you're fighting dragons. It's written on the tin.
Yeah.
Kill more stuff, get more loot was their advertising slogan a few years ago.
Kill bigger monsters, get better loot.
Yeah,
something to that effect.
When you're approaching a game like that, then absolutely somebody would come to you. It's like, well, I want to be a cleric, but I don't want any of the inherent limitations that are built in the class for balance. I want to be able to do whatever the hell I want. Or I'm generic justice guy, and you know I don't have to answer to any hierarchy of a church. So it's like, no. We're playing a certain kind of game, and you're bypassing balance. I don't really play games like that. Nothing right. wrong with them, but that's not really my shtick. To me, I look at that as, you know, you have your rule set, and say you're playing a game with a lot of classes and that sort of thing, and it has all these balances and stuff. Start turning the knobs and flipping the switches and going outside the box of what is expected. The game is something that I find really cool. And I think that a lot of stories can emerge from that. I look at stories that exist like in movies, the movie From Dusk Till Dawn. Perfect example. Imagine if that's a game and you're playing Hunter's Hunted or Dresden or Vampire the Masquerade or whatever. This movie has a character in it who is a religious man. He is a preacher from a church and he starts the game. His wife is dead. He has turned his back on God and he's trying to find himself, or possibly the movie hints that he just wants to die because he's so filled with sorrow, and he doesn't not believe in God. He hates God for taking his wife away from him. So it is a complete rejection of God, the Judeo-Christian God, and all that sort of stuff. Well, the movie's about bank robbers and shooting and this, that, and the other, and there's no spiritual element to it whatsoever until, spoilers, later on, they go to this club and things get really crazy and vampires. Guess what? They're real. Now you're in this spiritual realm. And there is this awesome scene where Seth Gecko, the
George Clooney.
Is Seth
Gecko. I'm not a big fan of his. I liked him in that role. And I'm generally not a big George Clooney fan, but
I think he's great in Syriana too. But anyway, and that one airport movie where he's traveling. Anyway, I like George Clooney.
Right.
But anyway, beside the point, Seth Gecko, we both agree, is really awesome character.
And not
great
Batman.
Tattooed, and not Batman.
Oh, worst Batman.
So the vampires have killed everybody. And they've killed like Seth Gecko's brother. And they've killed all these people, right? And they're like trapped in a closet. And they don't have anything. They don't have any, the gun. They've like, okay, yeah, I got a gun. It's got like one bullet. And, you know, it's that sort of situation. And George Clooney's character looks at the preacher and he's just like, you need to nut up or shut up. You need to get right with God right now.
Because he says something like, I don't remember the. I'm paraphrasing the scene. But something right. like, we've got weapons everywhere. We've got water. Bless it and make it holy water. We've got wood. We need to sharpen it and make stakes.
Yeah.
We've got other wood. You need to make crosses with them. And he's like, you know, yeah. you need to.
And the guy was like, you know, I don't know if I could do that. I got all this interpersonal, yeah, vampires at the door. I got all this interpersonal drama BS going on. And Seth Gecko's like, yeah, I didn't even believe in God until I stepped into this closet. Now the freaking vampire trying to kill us. You get over your shit and let's get out there. I mean, again, paraphrasing. But yeah, and the guy is just like, let's get those mother freakers. And then, you know, and then
monkey fighting.
Yeah, monkey fighting. And then they go out and he does it. And he turns and he starts the game as this non-believer or this anti-believer.
An
apostate. And as the game progresses, it changes. You know, there's no rules for that. There's no rules for that in Dresden. There's no rules for that in Pathfinder. There's no rules for that in D&D.
There are rules for fallen clerics. But
right. Well, and then you have to go, well, then he would have to say, okay, guys, I got to leave the club. I got to go tithe. Then I got to go do this. I got to go do that.
And I've got negative levels I got to work off.
Yeah.
I don't pick your edition. But
It's not very, very clean. But I think that makes an awesome game.
Right.
That makes a really cool game. Another one that I think of like that, too, think of Star Wars. Star Wars and Jedi. Very, very delineated.
Oh, yeah.
Jedi. you got your Sith, you've got your Jedi, you've
and
got your good
guys. Both
of
them have very strict codes. Both of them have very strict codes.
And, like, the Sith are pretty evil, but if you play, like, Knights of the Old Republic, they kind of subvert that expectation a little bit and make you kind of maybe not agree with them, but you're like, okay, I kind of see why. It's just not about killing babies. It's about something more. And even people who are like, I'm not Sith, I'm not Jedi, like, they're falling one way or the other. They're getting pulled in this direction. And if they're not good or evil, if they're not light or dark, then they get pulled one way or another really damn quick.
Well, that's a great
Except for one Jedi. There's one Jedi in there in Knights of the Old Republic, the original game, who is neither light side nor dark side. I forget what his name is.
Jolly Bindu.
And he rejects the sort of fascism, for lack of a better word, of the light side and the unrepented evil of the dark side. And he goes his own way. And if you make your own game and follow the canon set forth in the story, the implied story, you cannot play that character. But that character exists and he's awesome. And I would absolutely love to play that kind of character.
Right.
And he makes for a great story throughout the whole game.
Putting him aside for a second, because I'm still digesting how he would work into this metaphor.
Right.
Certainly the Jedi and Sith are a great example of individuals that don't follow a deity, that adhere to a code. Mm-hmm. And from the adherence of that code, there is a power that itself is non-theistic, that apparently is accessible to people of all kinds of mindsets.
Mm-hmm.
And yet
and
they
races
and races, whatever. Yeah. And they use those disciplines. They use those codes to create a way of approaching it. And so you still have pseudo religious strictures, even though you could theoretically be of any religion or no religion at all.
Right.
But there's still, you know, definite code that you can point to saying, OK, as a Jedi, you can do this. You can't do this. And based on what's going on, you know, you might start getting pulled to the other side, gainless powers, whatever. There's mechanisms both within the role-playing game and within the canon of the setting for handling that.
Yeah.
You know, I think something I can come up with here, I'm trying to think of characters that we've had like this.
Yeah.
The closest that I'm coming up with was Gnarl's worst half, Rot.
Yeah.
The gnoll that was kind of following him around, who was a cleric in class, but the gnolls were ancestor worshippers. And so they...
Yeah, you changed the trapping of all of his spells to be more ancestor.
And so he didn't per se have a single source of his power. It was like if he wanted to cast a healing spell, well, he'd look at the situation. And if the situation was somebody had gotten hurt during a hunt and the hunt needed to go on, he might try to appeal to an ancestor who's known and revered for his hunting prowess and see if that ancestor would step in and heal him or say, no, you need to nut up and finish finish this hunt like, you know, like a good gnoll. But whatever. But the point is that there was no specific single point of power that he was referring to, but it was still something external. It was still something that had a code around it. You know, these ancestors still had their individual trappings, but then as a whole, they were all gnolls, and so they were all looking for strength and perseverance and these things that would fit within a gnoll's interpretation of the world. You know, you could not go outside of the boundaries of that and expect them to still care. And so that's the closest I'm coming up with off the top of my head. I'm sure somewhere in all of our years of gaming, there's probably been a better example than that.
Sure.
But I think one of the things that's maybe limited a little bit is especially outside of D&D. Once you start talking about World of Darkness and such, Dresden to some extent as well. But we saw a lot in World of Darkness. Generally speaking, in our group, the people that were most drawn to religious characters were people that were themselves religious and were finding a way to express that in the game. The people that were not as religious typically did not go play religious characters. Not that anyone stopped them. It just wasn't, it's not a passion. They just weren't into it. Yes, weren't interested. This wasn't playing a man of God or whatever exactly the religious view was in the context of a game. Just didn't interest them. But I think once again, going back to as long as there is some kind of external code, this isn't some wibbly wobbly situational ethics. Flimsy whimsy, flippy floppy. I was trying to come up with a good joke, and I didn't get one.
It was a Doctor Who joke.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
But anyway. I don't know that I'd allow somebody to use purely situational ethics or pure utilitarianism of basically whatever seems And I realize I'm kind of simplifying these here, but whatever seems best to me at the moment is what we're going to call right. And that's
right. Welcome to Fear the Boot.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, it's funny. One thing you had mentioned, Chad, that when you're talking about there's not rules in Dresden for this kind of thing, and granted, in this particular case, my character does happen to be someone who does follow a god, but I kind of disagree in the sense that there are kind of rules to do that.
Because I'm sure there is rules in Dresden because they're so loose and interpretive.
Yeah, but you know,
I was kind of on a roll.
But no, and that's cool.
I was even thinking about it after I said, I'm like, oh, I'm going to get called out on this.
But you know what, though?
I'm still going to roll.
But deal. But the fun about it was, is that the rules actually really help to, you know, create the proper story situation for that one where... You know, something had happened to my character where the faith, I did, you know, I had an aspect of crisis of faith on there, and I was trying to overcome it, and while the character certainly wanted to overcome, I, the player, did not want it to overcome yet, and fortunately I failed my dice roll, but the GM had told me that even if I had succeeded it, he would have invalidated the roll because he didn't want that to go yet because he still thought there was still some story to be developed there, which he was absolutely right. But it's been good since then, and I like that kind of usage.
What goes into the making of a good religious character? You know, if you're playing D&D, it's cleric, whatever. Pat, I know that you're huge into paladins and such, or at least
love paladins.
And druids. And, you know.
Yeah. So what goes into making a good one, like story-wise? Let's assume that you have rule sets done, you've rolled up whatever. We've talked about you can play somebody who follows a concept, and you have a troubled past, and you don't believe in anything, or whatever. It doesn't matter.
I can give you four things.
Yeah.
Number one, an 18 wisdom. Number two, a 16 charisma. Number three, at least a 12 in strength. And number four, you probably want a 12 or better in con.
Would you say a blunt weapon as well, or...?
Yeah, because of the fact that classic D&D stuff, all the undead were resistant to piercing weapons.
Right. But what you want a Morningstar because it is both blunt and a piercing weapon. Mm. It's blunt and piercing. Yes. Best of both worlds. That's why my clerics always use a Morningstar because if I come up against the undead that are immune to piercing, I don't give a shit. My Morningstar is like a mace. I can beat them to death with it. And then
it's also piercing. Priest of Bob Marley. You always got a blunt.
I've always said, you know, that, like you're saying, the cleric class is, it's not hard to qualify for it because they don't have the limits on it, but you need to have more stats on the high end to be good at what you, because you're a little of, I mean, you're not a jack of all trades, but you're a little of everything.
Outside of the paladin, magic, I think they're really hard to stat. Yeah,
you're a magic, but you're also, you're a fighter. Yeah. I mean, I don't care what you say. Clerics make incredibly good, like a battle cleric is what I like to play. And good in combat. Yes.
Chris is like,
you need strength. You need the strength.
Clerics.
Talk slower, Pat.
You don't need dex. You don't need dex and intelligence. That's really the only thing you don't need as a cleric.
Could be a stupid, slow, wise beat stick.
Pretty much.
So that's all your clerics. So, okay, stats aside rule system. So that's Pat's quick and dirty. Here's how you roll up a cleric. That's cool. So now you got to roll up.
Now let's talk spells.
Exactly.
Cure light wounds? That's for other people.
You don't even memorize cure spells because you can
not
always
anymore.
Drop those.
Not anymore. All right. So what does make a good... I think... I mean, because... It's not the belief to me because... A role-playing game, I have always held that, I mean, it can be many things. And once again, I don't want to get into the bad, wrong, fun thing, because if you're playing games, whatever. But to me, a role-playing game is fundamentally the story of a certain number of characters, the player characters. And I'm not against great plot, strategic combat, whatever, I guess tactical combat. All these things are cool. But if these things are not feeding the central value proposition for me of the game, which is to tell the story of these characters, then it's all useless. And I don't mind plot driven stories that do it or character driven stories that do it or tactical games, as long as we keep coming back to that. Now, the thing about religious belief is, yes, religious belief shapes who you are and shapes what you do, encourage you to do this and discourage you from doing that. So it does have a certain prescriptive value that has to be executed in the game. But I think that is really cheating it because you're not telling the story of how did your character come to faith in this? What kind of person were you such that this became meaningful to you? Mm-hmm. Was there some experience you had that kind of made you see the wisdom in that path? Was it a family tradition? Were you raised within a church?
I think it'd be almost more interesting than playing, well, I am playing a cleric. I have this class. We're starting at third level, so that means that I've been doing this for a while now. And here I have written out that journey in my backstory. Now I'm going to have these other adventures. To me, it would be more interesting to play. I'm not playing anything. And we are going to role play out, well, at least I'm going to role play out my character's journey of faith from...
Well, and I think it also impacts the role playing pretty heavily, because if you sit down and talk to somebody, and let's say you find somebody in real life here, okay, who's a believer in whatever religion, but they're not just some crazy talking points person, you can actually have a deep conversation with them. Some of the most interesting stuff that you will hear is, yes, you may learn things about their belief at the level of doctrine or theology or dogma or whatever that you were not aware of, but it's the context of how this has impacted their life, how they came to that belief, how that belief affects them on a daily basis, the things that give them strength, the things that give them pause, the way that the stories
get pause.
It's essentially the how.
The stories. It may be the how, but I think it's also it's the why. It's asking the who's, the why's, the how's. It's putting aside really the what's and when's.
Yeah.
It's putting aside all the trappings and getting to the human story of what keeps you persisting in this faith and what drew you to it. And to me, that's what makes religious character. Mm-hmm. It's because anybody can take a one or two page write-up out of a handbook and say, okay, I'm going to play a cleric of this deity. Mm-hmm. And they become this just ridiculous talking head that's like, okay, I'm like, I had this one guy I wanted to kick out of a game and he was playing a priest of some god of war. I don't remember which one. He's like, I want battle to battle. We need to drink meal and have battle. It's like, dude, you say battle one more time.
I'm going to battle you.
I'm going to freaking 357 you. And it was like, it was really obnoxious. It's like, okay, but here's the point. According to the book, he's playing the character right. He wants to get drunk and shed blood. And that's what this god is all about. Mm-hmm. But there was no character there. Well, why is there no character there? Couldn't you play somebody who's of that same religion but has character? Well, sure. But how did you come to a view that you're not just war something you have to do, but it's a religious devotion? Mm-hmm. What kind of person does that take? And how does that affect your day-to-day life to live with that in your head? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really got to put you in a certain place, you know? Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get all political, but I mean, when you look at the news and see people doing both good and terrible things in the name of religion, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but some part of me wants to know, what led up to this? Mm-hmm. You know, where did this come from? What made somebody willing to do something this selfless and wonderful or this horrible?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's fanaticism on both, in either way that you go, because the good or the bad.
Sure.
It is a fanatic adherence to whatever it is that they believe.
But fanatic is a thing, once it's a...
Well, I'm saying it's not necessarily a bad word. I mean, it's describing a level of devotion.
Well, right. But that's kind of what I'm saying, though, is fanatic is a label we put on as a symptom of the behavior. What came before?
Yeah.
How did they go from being person on the street, baby in mom's arms, whatever it is, you know, however their religious journey began, to this? You know, what kinds of things are that took this person to this point? And every character I've seen that is religious that has not really moved me, at least in terms of the religious aspects of the character, that's been what's missing. Sure, they might be really good at playing a character who's devoted to the religion, but I don't believe that this character is a believer. I don't hear that journey. Real life story here. There's a guy that I used to be friends with. We didn't have a falling out or anything. I just haven't seen him a long time. It was a guy named Clark. I may or may not have mentioned him on the show before. I just don't remember. But Clark did time in a couple penitentiaries for meth running. And while he was in there, he himself was not a member of the Aryan Brotherhood or anything like that. But somehow he just ended up like hanging out with them. Like he just became part of their kind of, like he could sit with them and talk with them and they would protect him and such, which I'm not saying these are good people, but that's the reality in prison. Mm-hmm. You know, you're either part of a group or you're a victim. I mean, and it's... He had some interesting stories about prison that I don't want to get into, not because won't get into them, just because they're relevant to this discussion. But he ended up hanging out with the Aryan Brotherhood, even though he himself was not a part of the Aryan Brotherhood. And he was not a believer at the time. and he was living a very, very bad lifestyle. I mean, obviously, he's in jail hanging out with the Aryan Brotherhood, and he's there for running meth. Okay, mm-hmm. obviously, he's not on a good course.
They didn't get the wrong guy. They got the right
guy. They got the right guy, yes, and he'll tell you as much. And the only reason he didn't go down for something worse was lack of opportunity. He was prepared to do some pretty bad things. And when I met him at a church, and he was now a Christian. And because here we are outside of prison and he's still in a church. So clearly this wasn't some, you know, parole story. Mm-hmm. This wasn't, oh, I found Jesus, let me out, because he's out. OK,
yeah.
He's out. He's a free man. And going to church is not part of his, you know, parole or probation or whatever. I mean, you know, this is his own choice. So clearly he really believes this. And here's what changed him. There was the shot caller. OK, so the head of the Aryan Brotherhood, who's this guy's a badass. OK, I mean, sure. this is a man who's killed people. He's never getting out. And he was at the prison that Clark was in. He gets transferred out to another prison. So Clark doesn't see him for a few years. And then Clark, by coincidence, ends up getting transferred to the same prison the shot caller was at.
Mm-hmm.
One day, this guy who is, I mean, he's dangerous and evil and all these things. I mean, this shot caller there in Brotherhood, okay? I mean, if you've seen these guys, I mean, these guys are huge. They're muscular. They kill people all the time. I mean, this is not somebody you want to meet in under any circumstance. And Clark's sitting there and this guy comes up to his cell and says, Clark, you're coming with me. And this is not a man you say no to if you want to live. And so Clark didn't say no. He just asked the logical question, where are we going? Which is the only acceptable question in the circumstance, I guess. And the guy said, I'm taking you to church. And they went to the prison chapel, and apparently this guy, who's, I mean, just at, I mean, the worst imaginable situation.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, this is not a parole story, because he's never getting out. He's in for life. No possibility of parole, whatever. But this guy, who's a shot caller for the Aryan Brotherhood, had somehow, and I don't know his story, but he had somehow realized the error of everything he'd been doing up to that point, mm-hmm. and was turning his life over to a better path. And Clark was so blown away by saying, holy crap, he's done some bad things, but he is small fish compared to this guy.
Mm-hmm.
If this guy looks at this religion and sees something in it, there has to be something there. Now, you tell me, which is a more interesting story? Finding out that Clark can recite the Lord's Prayer or hearing that?
Right.
And that's what I think is missing from so many religious characters in role-playing games.
Mm-hmm.
I like what you're saying, and I think it's great. But I think what it boils down to is backstory. You're talking about the backstory of a character, and I think the issue that comes up with that a lot oftentimes is, unless you just run a heavy exposition game where you're going to let your characters individually sit down and pontificate, or not pontificate, but to just sit down and talk about this and have sessions like this, it's hard for it to come out. How is that story going to come out? Think up your character in your normal role-playing sessions. How is that going to organically come out?
Sometimes,
you know what I'm saying? It's like, other than just saying, sit down and say,
yeah,
hey, you know, well, and then if it doesn't, then that gets back to your point. It's like, I've got all this backstory and I know it myself, and maybe the GM does, but no one else does. And then there's the perception is from the rest of the group or whatever is, we've got a bad religious character because it never comes out.
But let me tell you how it comes out, even if the story is never told. Let's go back to talking about Clark here for one more second. If you guys will, you know, bear with me for telling a little bit more of a church story. One of the things that I came to admire about Clark was he had no patience for the people that, to use a phrase that's fairly often used within Christianity, people that were playing church. He had no room for people that were the hypocrites, the fakers, the people that would smile at you and then do all this ridiculous machinations. Why? Because of the circumstances under which he had come to faith. And to him, this was something very real and very important. If you did not live that, if you did not back your brothers and sisters, and you did not really mean it, you know, he would call you on that. And this is not a guy who was afraid to call you on stuff because of the life he had lived. He'd lived a very tough life, and he would call you on that. And even if you never knew his story, you would know that about him. Yet in most D&D games, you ask somebody, okay, you're a cleric. What deity you follow? This deity. The conversation might end there. The most you might get past it is, why? Well, agricultural god, and my parents are farmers. Really? Well, I don't have any doubt your parents probably had a little shrine where they burned a little bit of corn and wine to this goddess or something, but that's it.
Yeah.
There's this whole pantheon of gods and all this stuff going on or whatever, and that's how you picked your god? I mean, it sounds to me like you're just a...
Hey, man, you get a bonus to wisdom as the farmer guy.
It sounds like you picked him out of a book.
I mean, it sounds to me like, okay, you're a fighter or a rogue who has a belief system. You don't. This is what has made you devote your life to the precepts of this religion? Really?
I was the third son of a nobleman, so.
Yeah, they had to send me to the church to get rid of me. Okay, great story.
Actually, that's pretty interesting.
Go with it.
Yeah. I really hate the God I follow. I really hate the church.
And I'm stuck because I'm stuck here.
But guess what? He keeps trying to get me to follow him by blasting lightning out of my fingers.
Well, or look, I follow this God because when my own family threw me out, this god or goddess or whatever, this order, showed me the love that nobody else did. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you resent them for that reason. This is my dumpster. Yeah. This church is my dumpster for an unwanted third kid in line to a title. And so you resent the whole thing.
You know, I think about what you're saying too, Pat, and I get where you're coming from. A lot of people who play role-playing games tend to be proactive people. They write a backstory, and they put a lot of plot hooks in there, and they want that backstory to be in there. And it motivates their character, but they also want it to come out because, you know, you didn't spend your Saturday afternoon writing this for nothing, or the time you're supposed to be working during the week, you know, writing this for nothing.
I didn't spend my Tuesday mid-afternoon working on this.
Right. No, right? But, I totally get that. But I think there are a lot of people on the other side, like myself. I put a lot into a backstory. Maybe I don't necessarily write it all out, but I've got a lot of story behind my characters. Mm-hmm. You guys, and I say you guys, the people I game with, know a lot about my characters. You know a ton about them. You know a ton about my troll. You know a ton about my coyote. You know a ton about the farmer on the edge of town in the SOG game. You know a ton about these characters. Because I'm a loudmouth and I like to talk personally, so I tell you about them. Mm-hmm. But if I wasn't that kind of person, you'd know virtually nothing about my characters because my characters aren't really open books. I'm an open book, but my characters aren't. And I use their backstories and what I write to drive the characters, mm-hmm. to drive their motivations.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people do. I'm one of those. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always develop a good backstory. I don't necessarily write it down on paper but I always have that. But like I said, the mm-hmm. issue is in it coming out because it's going to come out organically in the story or not, you know, right. I'm with you though. And I think the worst approach to any character, not just a cleric, doesn't matter who it is, any character is just to literally say, I just wanted to play a rogue or I just want to be the cleric. So I just flipped it and I picked it.
This looks kind of interesting.
We need a healer, you know, whatever. So I have no real background. I mean, really, that's sort of this laziness on your part, you know, so it's easy to come up with some kind of a backstory. I'm just saying it may be harder for it to actually come out. Hopefully it will, and it will with your interactions with the people, mm-hmm. but it's not like, and not from the very beginning, I don't think you're going to have, not everybody around the table is not going to have a deep understanding of why you chose this path that you chose.
As far as it coming out, to me, that's never really, I don't really look at that as being a question, simply because the fact that it almost has to come out. There has to be examples along the way, because if you have that solid backstory, it is going to affect, and this is where I was talking about the how before, because it affects the way in which you play that character and certain behaviors and certain decisions he makes. And there is going to come a point in time where some characters can say, why do you keep doing that? Why are you doing that? You do that every single time we encounter the situation. What is the deal? And then that's that opportunity where those kinds of stories and that kind of motivation reveals can come in, because there is going to be a reason why that stuff happens to that character. And there's bound to be examples.
I think it's certainly that can happen. A situation like that can happen. I just don't think it happens all that often.
Really? I get that. I mean, there's a lot of people around the table with a lot of backstory and a lot of plot points, and to shoehorn in every single one, unless you spotlight one character doing one thing all the time, you don't want to create...
You know part of what I blame for that, though?
Chris?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much the whole thing.
Boom.
Yeah.
Boom.
Fear the Beast, right, done.
Mic drop. This was the last episode. Yeah. No. But no, it's... I think part of what I blame for that is in role-playing games, and I'm going to happily put myself in this category, because I think this describes most people, or many people in a role-playing game, is they are very, very egocentric.
Yeah.
When you play a role-playing game, you put a lot of thought into your character. There's something you have a passion for playing. That's what you want to do. That's what you want to be. That's what you want to investigate. That's what you want to see play out. I think part of the problem in a lot of role-playing games is the players do not take enough of an interest in each other's characters. Mm-hmm. And I think
at inception.
Yeah. I mean, how many times have you had an opportunity where there's the campfire moment, and nobody pulls aside another character and says, so tell me something about yourself. You reacted real funny every time we met a redheaded woman. What is it about?
You know who does that? Pat. Pat does that all the time in role-playing games. He will always pull people aside and have sidebars with them about, why did you do this? Oh, what was your motivation for that? Yeah. I've noticed you do that constantly.
And I've noticed in our games,
thinking
all the way back throughout our history, the games that we had that had the most successful character interactions, there was a curiosity amongst the players about each other's characters.
Right.
And that motivated a lot of conversations. I mean, one of the struggles that I'm having in a game I'm running right now is there's a lot of dead air when I try to get the people to role play.
Oh, that's, as a game master,
it's very frustrating.
Oh, the
yes, it
the,
is.
Okay, we've done all this. I've had, you know, here's all these NPCs and here you role play and there's role playing and then there's combat and there's more role playing and there's plot and there's big reveals.
Can you do something other than declare a vanilla action?
And then, you know, okay, now we're going down tempo and then you escape the city and the guards and you've lost the guards and now it's time to water the horses. What do you guys do? Well, we make camp. No. The camp's made. Guards are set. You're safe.
Right. I take first watch.
Yeah,
exactly.
No, we have that one. And you're just like, why don't you role play with each other?
It is hard in that instance because, like, what you're saying, the time around the campfire. The funny thing about it is that's a absolutely in world. That's what your characters are doing. Your characters, in their existence, in the fantasy world that they exist in, they're sitting around the campfire eating and having conversation, just like we all do, like we did earlier tonight at the restaurant. We had conversation. We didn't just sit there in silence, eat, and then get up and go. But it's like at the table, sometimes we do. Our group is, I think, very good about that, having those sort of sidebars and talking about things and doing some RP, but not everybody does because it's like, okay, yeah, that's a given. They're going to be talking at dinner. And let's get on to the next thing. We set watch. Does anything happen? Let's get on to the next thing. It's sort of a time thing. But
if your group has trouble doing that, what Pat just mentioned, it kind of gave me an idea of, say your group has trouble. It's like, well, what did we talk about? You know, we just did all the role play and stuff. What did we talk about when we were at dinner tonight? We talked about each other's lives.
Yeah.
And use that as a template. Go out to dinner with your group. Don't talk about the game. And sit back and kind of take some notes. What are we talking? We're talking about our jobs, our lives, our loves, and use it as a template.
I think I want to veto this topic right here because I think there needs to be a whole episode on this.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, rolling this back, because like I said, I think there's wonderful stuff to be said there, but I think this deserves its own episode. I came up with three questions. Okay. We have the group template and things like that.
Why do we shut Chris up?
Why do we shut Chris up? Why is Chris on the show to begin with?
Why do we care?
Three questions that I think if someone could answer these questions to me as a game master, I'd feel pretty good they're on their way to playing a pretty decent religious character. One, how did you come to faith in this belief system? We're going to presuppose you're not born with any pre-programmed belief system. How did you go from no particular belief system to this belief system? What's the story of that journey? Might be exciting, might not be, but I want
to
know what
it
that
doesn't
is.
Have to be, no. You know, I was...
It's a not, seed question.
I just want to make sure you've got some kind of story here about how you ended up there. Two, presupposing this is a world that has competing belief systems, which I think it's fair to say damn near every setting is going to have. Mm-hmm. You're going to have multiple gods, multiple religions, even disagreeing sects within the same religion. Why this and not another group? Why specifically in a world of competing opportunities or competing options, not only did you pick this one, but with the availability of these others, have you stuck with this one and not followed any other? I mean, surely you've been exposed, and if not, maybe that's an interesting point of discussion right there. Number three, and this is kind of reversing, I think, the way most people approach the religious classes like clerics and such. I'm not going to ask the person about their devotions. I'm asking a reverse question. Which part of your religion do you most struggle with? Mm-hmm. Which part do you find hard to believe? Which part do you find hard to follow? Tell me where your struggles are, because now you're giving me a sense that you are a person in a religion, not simply the avatar of that religion as described in the rules book. There's my personality. Let's play the game.
War, blood, healing.
Battle.
Yeah.
Blam.
And see, that goes to what I was thinking about a little bit earlier in this discussion, too, is I think best time for this to be done, or who it should be done with, is the character and the GM. I think this is a conversation that you want to definitely have with your GM when you're starting it. And I these three questions are great, because that's where that's going to kind of come out. And that's who I think really has the most interest in knowing
these questions
about your cleric, about why you've chosen this, is the GM. It's going to come out with their players, hopefully organically. But in the first place, I think the GM really wants to know this stuff. And I think that's the mindset you two certainly are thinking of, because you guys are GMs. I approach it from a different angle. It obviously is more player driven, and I think that's where my
I agree with you. I think this would still have value in game, because if you know the person has some kind of depth into why and how they pursue their faith, then that's going to create better role playing situations between them and the other.
I think these are three great questions for a cleric, for that, because they're seed questions. Like I said, helps them to come up with a character. I mean, those three simple questions really can develop a very strong and deep character that maybe people didn't think about at all.
Right.
And that all of a sudden, boom, that's the kind of thing that you think about, and that will spur you into, oh, okay, yeah, so I've got some facets of my character that I never even thought about. Now I do. And this is great. This makes it easy for me to play. It makes it easy for me to pursue this. So yeah.
Awesome. I think we're going to wrap this one up. I want to thank you guys for tuning in as always.
Exactly.
No announcements this week. Yeah. So this is a nice and easy one. So
Fear the Con.
Fear the Con, Sojourn, et cetera. You know, all this good stuff. Check the show notes. We'll probably have a couple links out there. Have a great week and great games. And we will catch you guys next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2014. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.